Paul, let me ask you something. Do you like your family?
It's a really complicated question, Steve. I didn't realize this is where we're going to be going right now.
No, I mean, do you like seeing pictures of your family?
Yeah, sure. Pictures of my family are nice. Yes, sir.
Okay, I've got a great recommendation for you. It is the Aura Frame. You've probably seen some of these before. You go to your friend's house and they have a frame on the cabinet or in the living room or whatever, and it has digital photos.
Sure. Yes.
Well, I got this thing and I set it up, super easy to set up. I basically dumped a bunch of photos from my phone right onto it. Very easy to do. Took me just minutes.
All this sounds scary to me.
No, it's incredibly easy.
It's not hard. Okay.
And basically you can put like, seems like an almost infinite amount of photos on this thing. And then you can set the parameters and it can rotate your family through like every 30 seconds.
Amazing.
And it's great because I've got pictures of my son, my family.
Cool.
My dad passed away a few years ago. I get to see him popping up every now and then. The good ghosts of your personal history coming through on this thing.
Nice. That's nice.
They have a great deal for Mother's Day, so listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code ChinwagPod at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
And welcome back, my chin-wagging compatriots. I am Paul Giamatti.
I am Stephen Asma. Welcome to the chin-wag.
Indeed. Welcome. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
A vortex of creativity.
Is that what it is? Is it a maelstrom of mental machinations, Steve?
You trumped me. Oh, my Lord. Yes.
Oh, it's a veritable whirlpool of whimsy and wonder. Boy. Oh, it really kind of is. I mean, for us,
it's maelstrom, least, I mean, for sure. Yeah, yeah, maelstrom.
Yes, it's a maelstrom. It's a complete whirly gig. We had so many questions about the majestic octopus that we didn't get to everything on our chinwag.
An amazing animal.
Peter Godfrey Smith, yeah.
It's like an alien on Earth. It's incredible.
It really is. Super, super intelligent. So here's the rest of our chat with this fine philosopher, Peter Godfrey Smith, author of Other Minds, The Octopus, The Sea, and The Deep Origins of Consciousness. This is, of course, your bonus wag.
Listener, it's Zach Harper, Amin El-Hassan, and Anthony Mays of Cinephobe. You may be asking yourself, what is Cinephobe? Amin, would you like to fill in the people?
Cinephobe is the podcast where Zach and I watch movies that are poorly rated on Rotten Tomatoes and try to ascertain.
We're trying to ascertain?
Yes.
Okay.
Ascertain. Whether or not they're accurately poorly rated, or maybe they didn't get a fair shake. Cinephobe, produced by this guy, Anthony Mays.
Hey, that's me. I produced this show. I also watch the movies, even though that wasn't included in the description, and I also ascertain. This month is... Whoa! Oh, Maze, why'd you say that? Supercharge it. So that this promo can remain evergreen.
I feel like explaining a little bit more.
In 60 seconds?
I don't know. Maybe I don't bring attention to it. Assuring people like, look, if you listen, you're going to get it. Just give it time.
That's a good promo. Just listen to it.
Give it time.
You'll figure it out.
Is this the promo right now?
Isn't it?
Okay, I think we got it.
Cinephobe.
Wherever you get podcasts.
You talk in the book about the latecomer view, which is that consciousness comes on at the end of this evolutionary process, and we have it, and maybe like dolphins and primates have it, versus this, what you're calling the transformative view, which is that there's sort of consciousness in some form really early on, and that it's getting sort of built up. But then, you know, I may be mischaracterizing Paul, but Paul is one of the last, he's one of the last idealists, and he's thinking more like sort of Blake and Goethe and Emerson. He thinks mind is first. Look at the company I just gave you, man. It's amazing.
I know. You're really, wow. Jeez, I'm like Goethe, wow.
Their bodies come afterwards. I know this is obviously not a scientific view, But people are also, alternatively to an idealism view, people are talking about panpsychism, that maybe consciousness is there in every bit of matter.
And every bit of matter.
Yeah, uh-huh. In every bit of matter. I'm just wondering, like, what are your responses to this? These options are interesting.
Starting with panpsychism, in that case, I do see it as a position that people find themselves forced to by the apparent impossibility of explaining how you could get experience coming out of something that was other than itself. You know, how could you start with atoms and non-experiencing matter and put it together in a certain way and experience or consciousness appears?
Yeah.
People look at that problem and they think there's just no way to solve that problem. So if we think that matter is real and not to be, you know, explained away in terms of mind, and we think that mind is real and we've just decided that it can't be explained away, you know, reduced to the material, then everything must have a bit of both and must have always had it from the start. So I do see it as a position of kind of last resort, a position you're pushed to by certain kinds of impossibility of explanation. And if we could explain how in animal life with nervous systems, with the kind of things that animals do, you can get consciousness arising from its absence, you know, from something, from a situation where it really wasn't there, then there's certainly no need to be a panpsychist because we've overcome what looked like that very difficult problem. Mm. And there's just no reason to believe it. I mean, a grain of sand, unless I'm given a really good argument for why there has to be a glimmer of consciousness there, it just seems like the way a grain of sand is just not the kind of thing that's in the in the ballpark at all. You have to be pushed there in the case of panpsychism. In the case of idealism, well, I actually haven't had a conversation with a genuine
don't put that on me. I'm not even sure what you mean, dude. It's like, what do you mean when you say that about me, Steve? I'm an actor. That's all I am. I'm an actor. I don't know anything.
But that was a common, I think your view is sort of like what was held very commonly before Darwin, which was, and you see it in biologists too, they thought the mind is there first and nature has been built on the structure of God's mind and our mind.
There's a kind of pervasive, energetic mind that's animating the universe. And yeah, I suppose that is sort of true. I mean, I've told you this, that I considered myself an atheist for a long time until I realized, bear with me, Peter, I believed in ghosts. So I was like, well, how can I tell myself a materialist or an atheist? And then I really sort of admitted myself, yeah, you're right, that in my mind, there's a kind of energizing, I don't know what you'd call it. There's a kind
structure
of flow
things,
of energy that's animating everything at all times. So I suppose, yes, that's true. Does this make me like a caveman? Does this just like...
You can't get tenure at a university.
I won't get tenure anywhere.
But you would have in Germany in the 19th century. You would have been made a big professor, you know.
Totally. Me and Schopenhauer going at it.
I'll close it off. I'll leave it alone. But one thing I really like about Paul's view and the sort of, and I'm a Darwinian like you are, Peter, but I do think that the Darwinians have a great way of explaining the causal mechanisms of nature. But, you know, and so everybody's now writing books on determinism, and now Robert Sapolsky has another book on determinism. But the beauty of...
What does that mean, Steve? Just define determinism.
It just means that everything you do is not really your free choice. It's just you're a meat machine, and the neurons fire, and you just like billiard balls hitting each other, shit happens, and the universe is kind of this giant machine. And while I think that's exactly what science has to do, the great thing about the romantic, you know, the nature philosophers, you know, the sort of von Humboldts of the world, is that their picture of the world was much more like our lived experience, like what philosophers call the phenomenology of experience. Like you walk around you take a walk in nature and you feel the poetry.
This is what it feels
of the trees,
like.
Yeah. Uh-huh, uh-huh. And it's just sad that that's gone away, or it's just been relegated to aesthetics, you know, and so they can't enter into study of nature anymore. But anyway, I'll leave it alone now. Thank you for indulging me.
Monsters are as old as humanity itself. Monsters embody our fears. Yet, they help us define the boundaries of what it means to be human. We know most monsters aren't real. Yet, we can use monsters to learn about reality. Psychology, biology, folklore, literature, critical thinking. We're on a journey to learn about the world through the lens of monsters. And we hope you'll come along with us. Subscribe at monstertalk.org.
You begin to, towards the end of that book, start to talk about language and the function of language. And you talk a little bit about that because...
And inner speech.
Octopuses don't have a language in theory unless possibly it's this ability to change colors. Is that right?
Yeah, I don't think they, and I don't think that would count. There's an interesting kind of sort of partial or halfway character to what they do. Language does what it does because you've got richness at the sending and the receiving end. You can make a lot of complicated signs, sounds, and the interpreter or the receiver can respond to those subtleties and do very complicated things in response. There's complexity at both ends. With cephalopod skin patterns, if we just look at their role within the lives of the animals, there's a huge amount of complexity on the production end, on the sending end. They make these astounding patterns and color changes. They can change the whole color of their skin in less than a second. And on the receiving end, inasmuch as they are directed at other members of their own species, which they are to some extent, because some of it's involved in mating and territorial disputes and things like that, it looks like it's much, much simpler on the receiving end. So it's sort of language-like or even more than language-like in its complexity on the sending end. But most of it's just kind of, the complexity is not going anywhere. It's sort of disappearing.
It's wasted.
Unless one has a romantic view of nature. In
yes. Unless one has some romantic view of it, that it serves some other purpose that we can't fathom. That we can't fathom why they collect the spikes from the ground and then change a crazy array of colors because there's some alien sort of communication going on between them and another octopus that we just can't comprehend, or cuttlefish, or whatever the particularly colorful ones are.
Or they're just contributing to the big energy field in the particular way that they do. I mean, once you open the door to those kinds of possibilities, there's a lot that could be going on.
Some of it could be, I mean, you sort of suggest, it's just a display of whatever cogitation's going on, that it's sort of, it's just following whatever they're doing or perhaps thinking, or even they're dreaming sometimes. You talk about one specific octopus that looks like he's asleep because his eyes appear to be sort of closed, so maybe he's dreaming. So it could be that too.
The dreaming stuff, this is another area that's firmed up since the book was written. Dreaming is always going to be very controversial, very hard to work out what's going on. But there are a couple of papers published in the last 12 months that start to make dreamlike states look,
really?
Look genuinely possible. Yeah.
Wow.
There's also been some amazing anecdotal stuff. There was a famous video, Heidi the octopus, going through dreamlike states in a documentary that my collaborator David Scheel was involved in, where the octopus was living in his house for a certain period of time. And impressionistically, it looks like octopuses go into a kind of a quiet sleep-like state and sometimes produce all sorts of patterns and colors. That's just impressionistic. And a paper was published, I think, maybe it was this year, actually. Yeah, it was this year, that looked inside the brain of the octopuses in sequences of this kind. And the brain activity makes it look like they have two phases of sleep, quiet and active sleep, as people do. You know, we have quiet sleep and REM sleep.
Oh, so there's a kind of REM thing going
on.
Oh, wow, fascinating.
Yeah, it's remarkable.
Yeah.
And during the active sleep stages, sometimes you get these intense bouts of patterning and color. Right. So do we then infer, okay, it feels like a dream. It feels like a dream to be doing this. Very, you know, I don't think we can say that yet. I think we'll eventually, I don't see why we couldn't eventually have a lot of confidence one way or the other. At the moment, I think it's fair to say it looks very suggestive that there could be dreamlike states in octopus.
What about dreaming in animals in general, dogs and cats, which are ones that we see, and primates and things? I mean, we're pretty sure they dream. I mean, that's
I know Darwin was interested in the I think in The Descent of Man, there's a section on do animals dream, and he's speculating by seeing dogs move when they're asleep. And but he says the dreaming is sort of like an involuntary form of imagination. I mean, he doesn't know this for sure, but he's just speculating. What are your thoughts on that, Peter?
I'd forgotten that he said that. I mean, that's, as is common for Darwin, pretty prescient. It does look quite a lot like that, increasingly so. Someone you might think of having on the show is a guy called David Pena Guzman. Uh-huh. He's a young philosopher who's written a book that came out last year. It's called either When Animals Dream or something very close to that.
That would be great.
It's a really good book. It's very good. He goes through the evidence, and he is quite convinced that lots of animals dream. Now, he's talking about mammals and birds. He's not talking about octopuses and other invertebrates very much. He has a little bit about the octopuses, but it's most the cases he wants to really press on are especially mammals, cats, rats, animals like that. And it does, I think, look very likely that there's lots and lots of dreaming in those guys. In the rat cases, this is what connects to the Darwin comment. There's some work that's suggestive on the whole point of this, which is that, you know, rats have internal maps of their environment in their brains. And when they're asleep, sometimes you can see from the activity that the rat is, you know, in its mind traversing a particular path through
That's really cool.
Its map of the world. And there are some studies suggesting that the rat is trying out novel paths, you know, possible ways of getting somewhere, desirable shortcuts, new ways to get where it wants to go with these explorations of its internal map while it's asleep. That's amazing work. It's incredible.
That's fascinating.
One thing I would add to what we were talking about a moment ago is the distinction between quiet sleep and active sleep. This looks like it's all over the place. Bees, flies, I think bees might have three phases of sleep.
Really?
Flies have a distinction between quiet and active sleep. And I find really weird, because the common ancestor of you and a fly, who is the same animal who is a common ancestor of you and an octopus, was this probably little worm-like guy about maybe sort of 570 million years ago or somewhere between 550 and 600 roughly million years ago, living in a time when, you know, being a worm was a very sort of high-end, you know, way of...
You were the shit.
You were the guy.
Yeah, that was the deluxe model back then.
Yeah.
And, you know, very small, probably a flattened worm. If the common... So if we have two phases of sleep and sleep itself, and a bee or an octopus has two phases of sleep, then either we both invented it separately and the common ancestor didn't have it, or maybe the common ancestor had its own really simple version of this. And I don't know which is a more amazing thing to think about, the kind of the double invention, or the fact that this worm was had its own version of those things.
Wow. Wow, that's wild.
Chinwag is a production of Treefort Media and Touchy Feely Films, hosted and executive produced by Paul Giamatti and Stephen Asma. Executive producers for Treefort are Kelly Garner and Lisa Ammerman. Dan Carey is executive producer for Touchy Feely. Our series producer is Rachel Whitley Bernstein. Original theme music by Luke Topp, with additional music by Via Mardot. Oscar Guido is our executive in charge of production. Tom Monahan is head of audio for Treefort.
Audio production supervision by Matt Dyson. Editing and mixing by Jeff Neal. Animation created by Alex Sokol. Research assistance by Aiden Brooks. Lastly, for more information, go to chinwagpod.fm and find us on Instagram or TikTok at chinwagpod or on Twitter at chinwag_pod.